Everybody, and a warm welcome. Beginning the class, and the recorder is on. So tonight is the second session in our series of Am Yisrael Chai. Tonight, Shema Yisrael, what Judaism has taught the world. And let me just start out. This don't come out too well on the recording, so I don't want to spend too much long on this for recording purposes. But what has Judaism taught the world? What can we say are unique ideas or ways of looking at the world or practices that have emerged with Judaism into the world, that we brought into the world, that our Torah or our people have brought into the world that wouldn't otherwise have existed? Yes, Joseph?
Monotheism,
the idea of one God. There are those who say that certain cultures, some Egyptian king at some point or other, had anticipated the idea of one God. So we'll see, even though we pride ourselves as the first monotheistic faith, first organized religion, monotheism, as we're going to discover, very arguably, that is certainly true and certainly the most famous, maybe the least important fact about Judaism is it was the first monotheistic faith. Anything else? No point throwing things out. Sandy. Value of human life. Sounds like a universal, but as we'll discover, far from. Anyway, Shirley.
Renee.
The
concept of Shabbat.
Shabbat, an excellent one. Shabbat really is a uniquely Jewish thing. Cholent, off the charts Jewish thing. But Shabbat, absolutely. Absolutely. Andrea? Okay, you shall love your neighbors yourself. We'll see to the extent that other, you know, religions have developed ethical ideas or you know, insightful ideas, important ideas. To what extent we can trace them back to be they originated first, would that have been, let's say, necessary? Take one last contribution from Ron, and then we're going to begin. So what Ron is saying is as follows. I'm translating this into other Latin, and then we'll actually touch on this a little bit. That what Judaism comes along and does is, and we have to understand that we in our mind's eye, or in our minds, may well be comparing Judaism, their seats at the front, sir, may well be comparing Judaism to Islam, to Christianity, to other religions, etc., that we're aware of, and and asking ourselves, what is the, what is better, what is superior, whatever. After we ask ourselves is the question, what is the background in which Judaism emerged, and how did people, the emergence of Judaism, sort of look and understand the world? And what Ron says is, even if certain ideas were intuitive, and the rabbis were fascinated by this idea, if you could learn moral behavior just from human experience, what Torah does is it places a religious, gives them a divine authority. To many, particularly to Greek philosophers, God wasn't that interested in God was a creator, but he wasn't necessarily the teacher and certainly not the supervisor or particularly involved in the running or caring of the world. He was literally well above all of that. Judaism comes along and says the being that creates everything also cares whether or not you keep your milk and your meat and dairy dishes separate in your kitchen, which itself is a remarkable idea. But perhaps I want to go at a little bit, maybe 10,000 feet above that. Let's get into our sheets. We'll start off with I have a few quotes tonight from Rabbi Sacks, as you could imagine, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Zechon Tzadik Libracha. Actually, somebody sent me today quite an old picture of myself. I think it was my first year in the rabbinate at a rabbinic conference, and four or five of us newbie rabbis were gathered together with the chief rabbi. Every time I see a picture of myself and Rabbi Sacks, it obviously brings back all sorts of incredible memories and wistfulness. So absolutely everything I say tonight could be based on a Rabbi Sacks kind of Torah teaching, whatever, but it won't be. Paul Johnson, who wrote a remarkable book called The History of the Jews, was an English intellectual, actually a Catholic. He'd also written a book called The History of Catholicism. Was an incredible Philo-Semite, And he wrote as follows in his book, History of the Jews. Certainly the world without the Jews would have been a radically different place. Humanity might have eventually stumbled upon all the Jewish insights, but we cannot be sure. All the great conceptual discoveries of the human intellect seem obvious and escapable once they have been revealed, but it requires a special genius to formulate them for the first time. The Jews had this gift. To them we owe the idea of equality before the law, both divine and human. And we're going to define all of these. This is a great kind of overture, because we're going to get to most of these in depth. The sanctity of life and the dignity of human person, of the individual conscience and so a personal redemption, of collective conscience and so a social responsibility, of peace as an abstract level and love as a foundation of justice, and many other items which constitute the basic moral furniture of the human mind. Without Jews, it might have been a much emptier place. And the reason why, and maybe, you know, I came here just to say that line or to say that paragraph. And I'll say why, not just this line, but for the entire series. Because it is very easy and it is natural. You feel the hostility, the Jewish people nowadays, the reflective hostility, which is just getting worse and worse and worse. And red lines have been crossed all the time, and there's hostility and more naked hostility and so on and so forth. And good for us for putting up with it. You know, not just Israel, but the way that Israel and Jewish people here fighting back on campus, fighting back now against UNRWA and all sorts of things. You know, my prediction is after October 7th, we will look back and we will see that October 7th changed many, many things. The universities, it'll probably change the United Nations. It'll change many, many, many things because of our refusal to put up with this anymore. But an equal and opposite reaction is to feel a little bit of uncomfortable. A sha-sha, don't make a fuss. What do you have to... And when people hate you, you kind of want to say, well, what can I do differently? What can I... So we have to understand that for the Jewish people, our own extinction or disappearance is not an option. We have every right to exist. But for humanity, the disappearance or assimilation or destruction, whatever way, God forbid, it can happen. Our enemies have lots of ways mapped out. The disappearance of the Jewish people for humanity would be an unrecoverable calamity. And this is not just about historical impact because, and I'm not mentioning tonight Nobel Prize winners or any of that, but it's important to understand what a burden we carry, what a duty we carry, what a privilege we carry, and what agents we have been in the redemption of mankind. And obviously, as a rabbi and as Jews, I'm going to say more tonight about the Torah and the fact that it's our privilege to carry these messages and interpret and teach and unpack and be loyal, etc. So that, to my mind, the vast part of this comes from the Almighty. I'm not here to talk about how many, as I said, Nobel Prize winners or college professors there are, etc. But look at the way that Jewish ideas from the beginning have changed the world and the face of the world. And there are a number of amazing books that have been coming out. When if you've ever been to the Hebrew, to the British Museum, I should say, and you see, you know, the Rosetta Stone, which opened up the ability for scholars to translate many texts from the ancient world, not just hieroglyphics from ancient Egypt, but cuneiform tablets from, of which there are hundreds and thousands, many of which haven't even been read. You know, in Mesopotamia, which was a very literary culture, they wrote on clay, and therefore it survived. It doesn't degrade like papyrus or paper, and therefore it survived. And as scholars have been able to unlock the ancient world, at first this posed a tremendous challenge to faith, because to Jewish faith. because turning to the literary or divine origins of the Bible, because if you believe that Hashem gave the Torah and you read creation stories, you read, for example, a flood, a story about a flood, Noah, the flood, the world nearly destroyed, but God saved the man and his family and an ark and whatever. And then you read the Gilgamesh epic, which preceded by many, many centuries the giving of the Torah. You kind of think, uh-oh, this isn't good. It turns out that the Torah is just really another book of myth from a long, long time ago. It's not unique at all. And then the Hammurabi Code, which is basically a code of law as opposed to narrative, which contains as many laws. This week's Parsha, Yitro, we start reading of the Torah becomes basically a book of law. And many of the laws. What happens if your ox gores his servant? Or you dig a pit and somebody falls into it? Or your slave runs away? Or you steal? What happens to you? And you find that, you know, this all sounds very, very, very familiar. So that's a huge challenge to faith. But in recent decades, and a project which only continues to grow stronger, many individuals began taking these texts in their own terms, understanding them in their cultural backgrounds, and seeing something emerge, that they are similar and at the same time entirely different, entirely different. So comparing creation myths, you can look at, we know we have, those were always available because of the Western love of Greek literature and mythology, etc. There are many, many, many different stories about creation and how the world came into being, and a multitude of creation stories. Is the Bible, Hebrew Bible, the Torah, the Chumash, is that similar or dissimilar? First two chapters are also a creation story. So this comes from a contemporary scholar, Jeremiah Unterman, Justice for All, How the Jewish Bible Revolutionized Ethics. Let's say here on page one, at the bottom of the page. In modern times, the abundance of unearthed ancient Near Eastern writings, myths, laws, treaties, temple inscriptions, prayer, wisdom instructions, have provided us with a wealth of information about the gods and their interrelationship with the world and its inhabitants. To be familiar with all these writings is an impossible task, as much material remains still unread. Nonetheless, certain key universal characteristics about these gods can be confirmed from published discoveries. Small g means idolatrous gods. And he makes three observations here. Number one, the gods are natural beings in the sense that they are no different than humans. They eat, drink, sleep, fornicate, make war, are born, even die, or can be killed. They are part and parcel of nature. However, while they are not supernatural, they are superhuman in such characteristics as strength, longevity. Some can even be resurrected, and other powers. In other words, pagan creation myths tell a story about gods with many, many, many human characteristics that are basically characters. Others, by the way, he doesn't mention this here, talk about gods and struggle with one another. Secondly, while possessed of superhuman powers, the gods are not omnipotent. As natural beings, they're affected by nature. They're also subject to time, magic, divination, trying to ascertain the god's plan that will affect humans, often in order to circumvent them, and destiny. You can affect the gods, make him different, make him do things he doesn't want to do. Ethically, the gods are capricious. Sometimes they behave justly, and sometimes they don't. Now, you can well understand how ancient man, thousands of years ago in the Fertile Crescent of Mesopotamia, trying to make sense of the world and nature and earthquakes and floods and pandemics and all sorts of things, would explain the world in terms of this volatile, chaotic, unpredictable universe of sort of chaos and capriciousness. Nor do these texts view the god as ethical paragons. Their attitudes towards humans are notably problematic. On the one hand, Mesopotamian kings see their divine charge as ensuring justice in society. They felt that Mesopotamian kings claimed to be the delegates of gods. On the other, Humans are created to be slaves to the gods, enable them to rest as befits their divine royalty. In fact, one ancient flood narrative has it that God flooded the world because humans were making too much noise. They were just like, God, like it was annoying. God, humans were getting on the gods' nerves and making too much noise. There were too many of them. The world became overpopulated. So he sent a flood to kind of wipe them all out, whatever. That's, you know, if you're living in the ancient world, pre-science, pre-enlightenment, pre-learning, this is good an explanation as well, but it shows as any, but it shows how you understand that the God, like humans must have been, you know, our job is to serve the gods, and if we annoy gods, then we're all going to be in for it. Just like my slaves exist to serve me, and if I do something terrible to my master, then who knows what might happen? He might drown me. So it's a reflection of the society that they lived in. So the ancient creation myths describe a society, certainly do not make prescriptions for the society. So, mentioned before, this idea of comparing understanding ancient texts, Hammurabi Code and other creation myths, etc., on their own rights, and understanding the huge moral differences, not just moral differences, but cultural differences, basically the entire perspective. So one of the first people, certainly in the 20th century, to become expert or to help kind of originate that field was a biblical archaeologist called Nachum Sarna. Nachum Sarna was, if I'm not mistaken, at Brandeis University. I think he was the grandfather of Jonathan Sarna, the father. Okay, the father of Jonathan Sarna. He was very, very important. He did not believe, and for full disclosure, he did not believe in Torah min ha-shamayim in the way that I do. The Torah is revealed. But he believed that the Torah is authentic. Whether he believed in what he meant by divine inspiration doesn't concern us right now, but more importantly, believes that the Torah emerges. It doesn't evolve. You cannot trace from some of these Emunah, Elish, or Gilgamesh, or other creation epics, you cannot trace a gradual evolution towards the stance of the first two chapters of Genesis, of Bereshit. But the Torah emerges, and it emerges with us, the Jewish people. Sometime in the Bronze Age and Iron Age, you have this tribe, this relatively obscure tribe of people, the Jewish people, the Judeans, whatever we call ourselves, carrying these ideas that will change humanity. This was so... I have a friend, by the way, who's an incredible Talmud Chacham. He studies Gemara Yevamot. There's sheets on the table. I believe there's still spare sheets. I have a good friend who, you know, in his spare time, he learns Masechet Yevamot. That's what a Torah scholar he is. He was actually enrolled in the Smicha program at JTS until he read this book, Exploring Exodus, and he switched to the Orthodox path. Let's look here at the bottom of page 2. And just, here's how, and I say this because these are ideas, and you'll see the impact of these ideas. To understand how Judaism has changed the world, or as Judaism has taught the world, what we're talking about, at least now, is the texts that are uniquely Jewish, that the Jewish people bring down into the world, or discover, or however you want to parlay around the phrase revelation, how these texts are radically different as night and day, chalk and cheese, from whatever has come before. And he writes as follows, Professor Sarna. Far different is the outlook of Genesis. And he's basically describing the same kind of ideas that Professor Unterman described in the top of the page. Far different is the outlook of Genesis. One of its seemingly naive features is God's pleasure at his own artistry. The repeated declaration after each completed act of creation that God saw how good his work was. Remember that. The first 6 days of creation, Vayar Elohim ki tov, and God saw that it was good. The Bible portrays from its first lines a world that is created not out of strife, not out of competition, not that it's eternal. A world that is created purposefully, to be deliberately, to be ordered, to be a place of Vayar Elohim Kitav that is pleasing to its maker and presumably supposed to be pleasing to its inhabitants. So the world, the bite, and we miss this because we're so familiar with it and we have nothing to compare it to. But the biblical story from its first lines about how light emerges in darkness, from tohu vavohu, from chaos emerges order, and this order is to be good and is a home for humanity. This is radical stuff. Nobody looked at the world and its creation before, not just as done by a God, not a God in Bereshit who makes demands. Okay, I've given you life, now serve me. But here, I've created a home for you, and it's beautiful, and you'll love it here, because it is an awesome place. That is the perspective of Bereshit, and that is, and we'll go and unpack from that, over thousands of years, incredible things unravel. And he'll put his finger on what some of them were. Following the creation of living things, we meet with the climactic observation that God saw all that he had made and found it to be very good. But this naivety of idiom cloaks a profundity of thought that marks off the mood of Hebrew civilization from that of the Mesopotamia in a most revolutionary manner. The concept of a single directing mind behind the cosmic machine, with all its ethical moral implications, emancipated Israel from thraldom to the vicious cycle of time. I'm going to read on for a moment, but he's actually saying something unbelievable. In place of a fortuitous concatenation of events, that also, this is not just, you know, multiple coincidences, one upon the other. History has become purposeful and society has achieved direction. A strong streak of optimism has displaced the acute awareness of insecurity. If I believe the world is created deliberately, purposefully, you know, in a faith lecture that Rabbi Sachs gave, I quoted this when I gave these faith lectures right before COVID began. Rabbi Sachs writes that he was giving a lecture he had given a lecture at Cambridge University on evidence of the existence of God, etc. And there was a famous scientist, a master of Trinity College, Cambridge, who had written a book called Six Numbers. The name escapes me for the moment. He'd written a book called Six Numbers. And it was basically a book that described how if six variables of the speed of sound or the element of weight, the specific mass for which electrons need to orbit, the nucleus, whatever it is, had any one of them changed, matter would have been impossible. There would be no existence. So a secularist, an atheist, a scientist could look at the world and think that it is miraculous. It's this extraordinary coincidence. And therefore, it's an amazing gift to be grateful for, etc. But it doesn't give you any reassurance about your purpose or meaning. More than that, it makes no statements of what you can expect to happen next. Not in terms of the sun rise or not. But will life have meaning? And is it contained for all its unpredictability? Is it contained and held by a higher force? So let me just go back to that word again. In place of a fortuitous concatenation of events, history has become purposeful and society has achieved direction. A strong streak of optimism has displaced the acute awareness of insecurity. The all-persuasive pagan consciousness of human impotence has given way to a profound sense of the significance of man and the powers he can employ. Ancient Greeks loved the story of tragedy. You can see tragedy as inevitable. You can see it in the roots of it earlier in the story. But the notion that inevitably we fail and we crumble and that life is ultimately futile, that is not the message of the Bible. Contemplating the awesome majesty of cosmic phenomena, the psalmist can yet extol the glory and dignity with which God has adorned man and the authority has placed in his hands. Turn over. This basic belief in the essential goodness of the universe was, of course, destined to exert a powerful influence upon the direction of the religion of Israel and to affect the outlook on life of the people. It found its expressions in the concept of covenant relationship between God and his people, and ultimately achieved its most glorious manifestation in the notion of messianism. Two uniquely Israelite contributions to religion. That God and man can have a covenant. We'll talk about that later on. And what's the idea of messianism? It's barely mentioned explicitly, really alluded to in the Chumash. Much later played out by the prophets. What is the idea of messianism? Mashiach now. Or Mashiach sometime. Hope. The notion that even though the world might get itself multiple times and act even provoke God's anger or allow ourselves constantly to bring it to the verge of destruction, that just like God created the world with hope, he will not leave the world without hope. This, Rabbi Sacks used to write about this tremendously in Pandora's Box. Hope is the one thing that the ill... What is Pandora's box? It's a box that contains lots of bad things. And somebody comes along. Was it Pandora who came? Who opened Pandora's box? Pandora, that's probably why it became her box. So Pandora opened Pandora's box. And all bad, terrible. There was one thing left. There was one thing left in the box, which was hope. And according to Rabbi Sacks, the message is of that, is that hope is also a bad thing. To the ancient Greeks, hope merely makes things worse. Because you know, life is really, really, really tough, but don't worry, hope springs eternal. So you begin to think that it's going to be okay. And then what's going to happen? It's not going to be okay. So hope just made things worse. Because it just made things worse, because you really hoped that things were going to be fine, and they weren't. That's how the ancient Greeks looked at hope. It's futility. Why? Because the world is really random and there's no control and nothing you can do. Whereas Judaism has an idea of Mashiach, of messianism, of hope. Hope that will come as much as we'll see as a partnership between mankind and God. That is this church. Hope that will come as a partnership between man and God. But that hope exists, that because God created the world not accidentally, but purposely as a home for mankind, and gave laws and mitzvot and directions, instructions, and cares what we get up to, he will not allow mankind to destroy itself. That is a lesson and an authentic, not only is it a theoretical belief, but it gives, and arguably this explains a tremendous amount of Judaism and Jewish philosophy. Because what it says is that I know that even if I won't see the fruits of my endeavors in my lifetime, my endeavors to better humanity are not futile. They are worthwhile. That is an incredibly important idea which infects the way the Jewish people are able to recover from tragedy. And in fact, I don't really have this on the sheet, so I'll just say this now. Arguably, and I've seen some Christian theologians, and I don't want to say that I've spent the last 2 days, over-reading, but I've seen some Christians who say that maybe one of the Jewish people's greatest contributions is to live with the dignity of perpetual setback without giving up hope. And what Professor Sarna says, and that's a profound statement, and what Professor Sarna, which is not said to be reconciled to setback, but even when it happens, to nonetheless not give up hope. And what Professor Sarna argues is that comes from the Jewish understanding of creation itself. That the Almighty created the world with purpose and therefore has a plan to, not just a plan, has an agenda so that the human beings do not have to worry that they live in a world whose creator has vanished. And we'll see what the famous midrash about Avram about that in a moment or two. The God of Israel, being a deity whose will is absolute and incontestable and whose words is eternal, was able to give assurance that human strivings were decidedly not in vain. Israelite society did not suffer from quote-unquote overtones of anxiety. We Jews, of course, are anxious people, Norman LeBret wrote an amazing book, which I strongly recommend, called Genius and Anxiety, about contemporary Jewish experience in the last 100, 150 years ago. But the notion that for no reason at all, of course Judaism grappled with the problem of evil. How come good people suffer? How come empires collapse? How come we're in exile? How come all of these things happen? But nonetheless, the idea that there's an author behind this, so that it happens for a reason, and it will find its limits, is a liberating idea, because it means that human endeavor is always, always worthwhile. Now, finally, some Rabbi Sacks, because Rabbi Sacks takes another reading of, and all of this is really an interpretation of the first few lines in Bereishit. Already, this story about God creating a world that is good and bringing mankind, Adam and Eve, and placing them in the Garden of Eden and telling them, I've created this world for you. Look how pleasant it is. Look how beautiful it is. This, from this chapter, these two chapters of Genesis, flow a whole worldview that is absolutely, number one, in strict contrast to everything that's come before, and number two, from which eventually, whoever's phone is doing that, do you mind just silencing it, please? And from which flow this tremendous amount of inevitably, over centuries and millennia, will develop a way of life and a culture and a way of looking at the world. And look what Rabbi Sacks says here on page 3. Because Rabbi Sacks identifies another theme. What is God's relationship? What is God's relationship with humanity? How does God view the human beings that he creates in Bereishit? And us? What is our role in this world? Sorry? Could say partners. We have, I think, as we've seen, on the basis of, because we just know that it doesn't ring true at all, we're not in the pagan world exist to serve the gods. We don't exist to be, you know, the brunt of sort of divine joke or to carry out divine orders that are capricious or meaningless or purely, you know, punitive. So why does God create mankind? So Rabbi Sacks points out, and this is actually an extract from a much longer and somewhat complicated piece, but and he traces it back to Bereishit as well. Over here he's quoting later Nevi'im prophets. However, what is really striking, what is totally stunning, is the third metaphor, which is so beautiful, so powerful, that frankly I'm overwhelmed by it. It reaches expression in the great literary prophets and Isaiah, Jeremiah, and above all of Hosea, and what understand and which understands the relationships between God and humanity. God and humanity, although very specifically God and Israel, but I really believe it between God and humanity, as a matter not between master and slave, not between Adon and Eved, and not even between Av and Ben, parent and child, but between husband and wife. This is a really explosive, stunning image which marks the Jewish understanding of the human-divine relationship as unique and totally without analog anywhere else, that there are comments, and he argues that you can trace it back to Bereishit itself, where God said, Lo tovi od adam levado, it is not good for man to be alone. Rabbi Sacks really proves in literary analysis that God is speaking much about himself as well, that he created mankind who is aware, God is empathetic for mankind, creates him, and creates them with needs that he will help him fulfill. And Rabbi Sacks says that ultimately the vision of the creation of mankind is a marriage. And now we believe this. I'll tell you why. Because Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. What's the next pasuk? Baruch Shem. V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha. Judaism is predicated on the basis that we don't exist just to serve God. Certainly not when we talk about serve, Avdut, we mean to worship, revere God, so we know our place. We don't exist as God's gophers or servants or builders or what have you. We exist as people who can have a spiritual relationship with God. That to be close to God is a wonderful thing. the entire mystical tradition that says that God, even when you feel him absent, is there, is hiding in the universe. And to the extent that the human soul is able to transcend the hidden nature, the veil of this world, and see the divine in everything, and access the divine in everything, and have moments, maybe a lifetime, maybe a split second, and an entire lifetime, of immanence with God, of closeness to God, of dveikut with God, then you've redeemed an entire lifetime. And Judaism teaches the possibility that human beings cannot just, you know, love God in the sense that I love my great auntie. I'm supposed to, you know, kiss her in Rosh Hashanah when she got to love God with a passion, to love God with a way that helps carry you through all. We spoke about this in the Rabbi Lam lecture before Rosh Hashanah. To be in a relationship with love God that makes all the questions and good, strong complaints you have against God irrelevant in the moment of that closeness of God that you sometimes feel. That comes from the Jewish vision of Bereshit, that God creates us out of love and because he wants to be in a intimacy with us. And that's why the later prophets, not so much in Bereshit, but the later prophets will describe God's house. And in fact, the book of Hosea says, you'll no longer call me Ba'ali, my master. You call me Ishi, my husband. There's a relationship, a marriage between God and Israel, which is why when we put on tefillin in the morning, when men put on tefillin in the morning, when we wrap the straps around the fingers, what are the psukim we say? It's like putting a wedding ring on your finger. I'm betrothed to you. These ideas are, I mean, you could say Christianity is a religion of love. They didn't always display their love to us so much. Islam also, and I'm not talking about politics, I'm talking about it at its essence. There are aspects of mysticism and divine love and encounter in all religions. But it comes from an interpretation of these texts that emerge with Judaism. The next thing I'll say, and I won't spend too much time on it, is, because somebody already mentioned it, Shabbat. Shabbat is a radical idea. I'm just sort of say this as kind of an aside, because it's somewhat related to the creation story that we're still sort of, for the moment, just still holding by. But the notion that God created the world and rested, which is clearly, and God doesn't need to rest. Every biblical conception of who God is a God that is self-sufficient, to say the least. So when the Bible tells us that God rested, this week's parsha as well, Ten Commandments, keeping Shabbat, what it's really identifying is a human need to rest and experience and not to work. Humanity was not always as fortunate as we were. There were times when life, well, the vast majority of human history, life was nasty, brutish, and short. Maybe previous generations, I hope future generations will look back and our life as, you know, as equally nasty, brutish, and short. Maybe a redeeming feature is that we don't understand yet what, you know, how much less nasty, brutish, and short could be. But humanity lived very often in sustenance levels. Ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans ridiculed Jews for keeping Shabbat. How would you not work? Or why would you be idle? Why would you be idle? Why would you just take a day and not do anything deliberately? It is a remarkable idea. It's an idea that, you know, to this day, more and more people discover the idea, has a remarkable hold on the Jewish people. Even though, regrettably, you know, it used to be that to be a Jew was almost synonymous with being Shomer Shabbat, and now it's not. Shabbat still has a claim or a magic, an internal logic, a language of the soul. And Shabbat is an idea without question. There are no forerunners to the concept of Shabbat, a Sabbath, anywhere in the ancient world. Turn over to the next page, and I'm going to talk about an individual who I think one or two of you may actually know personally. It's certainly spoken in our shul from time to time. But another one of this new breeds, and very much living breed, thank God, of contemporary biblical scholars who make a great, who really have phenomenal scholarship in comparing Torah to the assumptions and attitudes of the religious world in which it emerges. Now, Professor Joshua Berman, Lola, did you ever go on one of those? Did you ever go to Egypt with him? So you and Herzi, right? So, oh, just you. So I know that a number of people in the shul had. So Joshua Berman has also written an amazing book called Ani Ma'amin, I believe, where he sort of demonstrates on the basis of biblical archaeology the truth of the Yetziat Mitzrayim story, and runs tours to Egypt, if that's your kind of thing. This work, that's this kind of new kind of focus. This going back 10, 20 years earlier, I find absolutely fascinating. Because what I want to share now is not just a sort of attitude about the way that Judaism, the way the Torah tells a story of God and creation, and God and creation vis-a-vis mankind, from which you can already anticipate how mankind is supposed to see itself as created for a reason, for meaning, by loving, benevolent God. All of that already places Judaism on a path to completely alter humanity. But when it comes to the contents of the Torah, this is actually really quite timely. This week's parsha, we have the Ten Commandments. Starting next week, we have the Seder of Mishpatim. It's where all the fun gets sort of tucked out of the Torah, and suddenly we're reading about if you lend a sheep to somebody and then it's eaten by a wolf, if you had paid the guardian, then you have to, you know, then he owes you money. But if he'd asked you as a favor, if he'd asked you to borrow it, that's one thing. But if you'd asked him to look after it, it's another thing. All of this suddenly starts coming. So what's the deal with that? So it's true. There's no question about it. It is true that if you look in ancient legal texts like Hammurabi Code and others, you will find parallels. You will find stories that sound, or laws that sound at on the surface to be similar. What's fascinating is when you look at the moral basis of the laws, what is the law actually under these circumstances? You begin to see phenomenal things emerging. And it is inescapably, undoubtedly, the question that it follows as night and day from the biblical conception that humanity is created b'tzelem Elokim, two words that I didn't even mention before, that man is created in the image of God. Mankind is created in the image of God, despite the chosenness of Abraham. All of mankind is created by God, beloved by God, and therefore, law does not discriminate between classes of people. I believe that the gods communicate only with the kings, or a priestly class is considered to be above the law, as you were in ancient Egypt. The Torah describes at the end of the book of Bereshit how the priestly behavior in Egypt was, a separate class entirely, you know, relieved of and distinct from taxation and all sorts of other duties. So the Torah does not describe a hierarchy of human beings. It doesn't describe an aristocracy and a peasantry. It doesn't describe a rich a law for the rich or for the poor. In fact, one of the most overlooked biblical verses, just because it comes up so often that we just tune it out, Torah achat ye lachem. There shall be one law for you, meaning that when it comes to criminal and civil and financial law, the law does not discriminate between classes of people. That was an absolute it is still a radical idea. What is the point of having loads and loads and loads of money or power if you can buy yourself out of legal problems? No disrespect to any lawyers in the room, but that's how we look at the world. And I'll say, I'm just, if any one of us was to be arrested, And on some traffic infringement or something like that, we would, number one, be outraged, and number two, absolutely think that, well, you know, I don't care what happens to other people in this circumstance. You know, I don't deserve to be treated this way. We have this natural sense of privilege that we carry through our lives. The Torah says that sense of privilege belongs equally to all human beings. So here's what Joshua Berman has to say about this. Torah, and this is from an essay they wrote quite a long time ago. And he writes as follows. These innovations were presented through the narrative of the Exodus and the covenant at Sinai. Stories that would have made a distinct and unusual impression on the ancient mind. The ancients, he's talking about stories really of our parsha, of the giving of the Torah. The ancients, and listen to this, actually a fascinating idea. The ancients had no problem believing that the gods could split the sea or descend on a mountaintop in storm of fire. If you showed somebody from an ancient Mesopotamian, you know, the first few chapters of Shemot, they would have been like, yeah, okay, I could see, you know, yeah, I see that. That's probably the whole point of the Chartumei Mitzrayim, that there some or other god is speaking a religious language of signs and wonders that ancient cultures got. In contrast, the stories of the Exodus and Sinai necessitated enormous stretch of the imagination because they required listeners to believe in political events that were without precedent and utterly improbable, even in mythological terms. The ancient world believed in gods that could split a sea. They did not believe in gods that could take slaves out of slavery. Why? Because why would a god ever do that? Why would a god care if you were a slave or not? Slaves had never been known to overthrow their masters. Gods had never been known to speak to an entire people. Moreover, in propagating the story of an enslaved nation rising up and breaking its chains, the Bible also preempted claims of election, social hierarchy within the Israelite nation itself. The Exodus narrative effectively disallowed any Israelite from laying claim to a naturally elevated status. It depicts the origins of an entire people, a seminal, emancipating, but most important, equalizing event. The Torah describes, the Torah's audience is the Jewish people. So the laws of the Torah that we start getting in this week's Parsha, then next week's Parsha, and for the rest of the Torah, the audience is, God is legislating for the Jewish people specifically. But, with the exception of ritual laws for the Kohanim and for the Levim, everybody is equal before the law. God commands everybody, and no class of people can arise and say, I am above the law, or the law doesn't apply to me, or I have different laws. This is such a radical idea. Can basically say, and what he's saying is, because God took the entire Jewish people out of slavery, and despite the fact that the people didn't want to hear the Torah because it was overwhelming, when revelation happens in this week's Parsha, to whom does God address? To which part of the people does God speak at Har Sinai? The entire people. So nobody can say, well, I'm a different class, I'm a different category of citizen than you are. In ancient Athens and Greek political states, most people weren't citizens. To be a population, to be a citizen, was something entirely different. In Judaism, every Jew is a citizen of Israel. This is an incredible idea. And by the way, somebody, one of these scholars, I don't remember now which one, points out an amazing thing. If you think about it very, very quickly, if you think about Parsha Shoftim, God describes, Moshe Rabbeinu tells the people, what's it going to be like, under what circumstances can the Jewish people have a king? Micah, we're short of time, so you can answer. How would the Jewish people get a king? If they demand a king. If the people say, Som tasim alecha melech, please place upon us a king. That's a radical idea. Kingship, rulership comes when the people request it, not when the king imposes his will on the Jewish people. Again, these Torah ideas are extraordinarily radical. Although the account of the revelation at Sinai is usually conceived in religious terms, its political implications are no less dramatic and constitute the bedrock of Bible's egalitarian theology. Elsewhere, the gods allegedly communicated only to the kings and no interest to the masses. At Sinai, God spoke to the entire people without delineating any role whatsoever for kings and their entourage. In fact, in light of archaeological findings now available to us, we can grasp how the Sinai narrative transformed the entire people of Israel into a collective of king-like individuals. And in that light, we can now understand a famous verse from this week's Parsha, which is at the end of chapter 19 of the book of Exodus, before the Torah is given in chapter 20, Moses approaches the people, or God sends Moses to the people and says, if you hear my word, you will be Mamlechet Kohanim. You will be not just Kohanim, you will be a Mamlechet Kohanim. Gods in the ancient world only ever spoke to kings. This God will speak to the entire people. Why? Because there is no difference in the people whatsoever between who is a king and who is you'll pardon the expression, a commoner. Now, turn on to page 5 very quickly, and this is staying with Nachum Sarna, going back to Professor Sarna, because this explains, by the way, and there are radical, radical differences that affect the Torah. If you ask most people, what is the origins of our belief in equality, human rights? Somebody said the sanctity of life. Where do these ideas come from? Most people would say, or many, many people would say, they come from the classical world. They come from the philosophers of ancient Greece and ancient Rome. They come from Cicero and Aristotle and Plato and Socrates. They come from the great, great classical. After all, the Renaissance was, you know, the West's rediscovery, Christian Europe's rediscovery of lost learning. So there's a lazy assumption that really, you know, certainly from a Christian, from not just a Christian society, but we've all infected a little bit, that the Old Testament is a violent, the God of the Old Testament is vengeful and angry and wrathful. The New Testament is all about love and tolerance, but real wisdom and civilization come from Greece and Rome. That is not true in total. What I'm going to say, this Sarna is dealing with, again, the religions from which, or the society from which Judaism emerges. But we'll say a word about some of the values of classical Greece and Rome as well. So back to Nachum Sarna at the top of page 5. Typical of the law of Shnuna. Shnuna is another one of these Hammurabi code-like creation stories and law books, and especially of Hammurabi, are graduated penalties according to the social status of the victim. And now again, this may well be how in practice the criminal justice and certainly the civil justice, is that such a phrase? The civil system, no, I'm not being facetious, I don't know the name for it or whatever, but you know that is entirely, you're more likely, I imagine, to be arrested and fined and penalized if you smash somebody's windows on Park Avenue than you are if you smash somebody's windows on, you know, in Harlem. That's just the way the world works. But it shouldn't work that way. It's just the way that we administer the world. Ancient texts that precede the giving of the Torah actually legislated that. So that was naturally the way that you would run the world. That if you attack a free person or an aristocrat or a rich person or nobleman, then of course your punishment is going to be far worse than if you attacked an ordinary person. For instance, if a man strikes a pregnant woman of the awilum, or upper class, and causes her to miscarry, he pays 10 shekels of silver as compensation for the loss of the fetus. If, however, the victim belonged to the mushkanim, or class of commoners, then he pays only 5 shekels of silver, because the legislated class differences were absolutely considered to be perfectly natural. Some people count more than others. But the point of the Bible is this uniquely Jewish idea that nobody counts more than anybody else. Because every human being is created B'Tselem Elohim. The Torah, on the other hand, knows nothing of social stratification in matters of adjudication. It dispenses equal justice for all irrespective of class distinction. The sole exception is the slave, whose status will be discussed presently. A very strange aspect of some of the laws is vicarious punishment. In several cases, the offender does not pay the penalty, but someone else who stands in relation to him. For example, in the Middle Assyrian laws, the rape of an unbetrothed virgin who lives in her father's house is punished by the ravishing of the rapist's wife, who also remains, therefore, with the father of the victim. And it's talk about, you know, an eye for an eye. If you, God forbid, rape somebody, so the punishment is that a relative of yours will be raped in vengeance. That's barbaric. But that's how people saw the role of law. Hammurabi decrees that if a man struck a pregnant woman, thereby causing her to miscarry and die, it is the assailant's daughter who's put to death. You killed his daughter, therefore we're going to kill, you killed his child, we're going to kill your child. If a builder erected a house which collapsed, killing the owner's son, then the builder's son, not the builder, is put to death. Judicial vicarious punishment is unthinkable in the Torah. In fact, it is explicitly outlawed. In Deuteronomy, parents should not be put to death for children, nor children be put to death for parents. A person should be put to death only for his own crime. Judaism does believe, at least theoretically, if not practically, in the death penalty. But you might read that pasuk 100 times and scratch your head. Why on earth would I have thought that we would execute children for the sins of their parents? So we'll give all sorts of homiletical interpretations until scholarship and biblical archaeology throws a lens in this and say, no, actually, the Torah is this incredibly, incredibly radical break with the way that people view, the way the world was before the Torah came on was an entirely different world. And just very, very quickly, we'll just read one of these texts at the bottom here. And Aristotle, for example, regarding the value of life, euthanasia is something that was commonly practiced in ancient Greece. And the notion, you can't talk about a whole culture in a sweeping statement, but for many, in many places and in many eras, it was considered quite acceptable to take the elderly or the infirm onto some kind of a rock and just leave them to die. That is not, you know, no matter what you might think about the looming social security, you know, bubble or crisis, whatever, that is not a way that we would tolerate that. And therefore, our insistence on the value of life comes from Judaism. So Aristotle actually said, there must be a law that no imperfect or maimed child should be brought up. And to avoid an excess in population, some children must be exposed. For a limit must be fixed to the population of the state. They believe for good, practical, moral, you know, the greater goods, to practice infanticide and all sorts of a and all sorts of other values. We're almost out of time, so just turn to the last page, just very, very quickly. Because, and as somebody pointed out to me, when I said, somebody asked me a little earlier on, what's tonight's topic? And I said, it's called What Judaism Has Taught the World. They said, well, that's a big topic. So clearly we haven't scratched the surface. But there's one more point that I want to touch on. Because a lot of what we've spoken about tonight is by definition, the origins. What the Judaism, from its early foundational texts, which I pray that you believe as I do, are divinely given. But paradoxically, if you actually think the Jewish people made this up, then it actually makes a genius even greater, because these texts emerge without parallel or anticipation. They don't, as I say, evolve. They are discovered. They're discovered in by the Jewish people in the most ancient of times. But beyond that, there's an entire Jewish philosophy that arguably comes from these texts, but is absolutely foundational to what Judaism has taught the world. And that's a question of, what's our role in the world? What are we for? We spoke last week about why God created the Jewish people. Why did he create humanity? So one answer, on the basis, which is implicit in what we said before, is that we're created to be the recipients of God's love. God, by definition, an all-merciful, a loving being, himself cannot exist alone. Paradoxically, God cannot live without existence, because he quote-unquote needs to be able to pour his goodness and his essence and his love and his giving nature into recipients. That's ours. And that's one powerful answer to that question. But when we talk about what are the, but all of us understand that we're not here just to sort of soak up God's life. Life can't be one long yeshiva break in the Caribbean. It can't be. It's not. And I actually find too much leisure time actually soul destroying. So there's another Jewish answer to the question. And Rabbi Sacks pins it on the famous Midrash. Last week we spoke about the fact that when God, unlike Moses, who has a backstory, prince of Egypt, Jew, but prince and Jew, Noah, who the Torah tells us was an Ish Tzaddik, who walked with God, Abraham emerges without any warning. God suddenly says to Abraham, Lech Lecha. So there's a Midrash that says that Abraham is wandering in the desert and he sees a palace on flames and nobody is putting out the flames. So Abraham says, isn't there a Balabait? Like, isn't there somebody in charge around here? And immediately God appears and says, I'm the Balabait. I'm in charge. That's the Midrash. And that is how a classic rabbinic interpretation of why Abraham, or what's the role of not just the Jewish people, but what how are human beings supposed to interact with the world around them? And we'll finish with this this paragraph of Rabbi Sacks at the very top, Judaism's project. In other words, faced with conflicting evidence between order and chaos, between God and evil, it would have been so easy to deny the reality of one or the other. What Rabbi Sacks says is when we think about evil in the world, we have two conclusions. Either there is no God, and therefore the world is terrible things happen naturally because they just do. Or we say there's a God in the world and he runs everything, so there is nothing really bad. Everything that happens is ultimately for the good. Gamzula Tova. Gamzula Tova. The Holocaust, Gamzula Tova. October 7th, Gamzula Tova. Everything has to be good if you really believe in God. Rabbi Sacks says Judaism emerges from the refusal to accept either one of those contentions as either or. And Judaism refuses the premature and easy options, despair on the one hand, consolation on the other. If either of these logical alternatives were true, either there's no justice or everything in the world is just, then we could live at peace with the world. But to be a Jew is to refuse those easy answers and to live within the tension which sees evil as real and therefore rejects premature consolation, acceptance of the world. And it is also to say that God is real and therefore hope is not an illusion. If God exists, then life has a purpose. If evil exists, then we have not yet achieved that purpose. Until then, we must travel, Lech Lecha, like Abraham and Sarah traveled, and as Jews have traveled ever since, El Eretz Asher Recha, to the land which I will show you, which is always just over the horizon, which is always not quite yet. In other words, Judaism exists as a response to the fact that on the one hand we believe in God, on the other hand we see a world that is far from godly, and it is therefore our job to intervene and to make it better. That is what Judaism says the role of all humanity is. That's the project of Torah. That's why the Torah contains so many mitzvahs. There are things to do. There's a social conscience. There is a society to fix. There's a vision to bring into the world, a vision of peace and harmony, security, food for everyone, a curing of illness, that man is not just partner of God, but man is responsible to make sure that evil is vanquished. God never makes a claim that human beings are supposed to be passive and he will take care of everything. And that is, if you like, perhaps the most important discovery of Judaism of all. So let us pause here.